Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 1119. Sign up for the ID10T.com email list. It's very simple. You go to ID10T.com. Look around while you're there. We got a lot of fun pop culture stuff. And on that tip, see, if you sign up for the email list, then you don't have to go to the website all the time. We'll just alert you when new things are put in the store that are pop culture oriented and relevant to your interest, probably. But it won't come to your inbox so many times that it'll be annoying, but just enough to be like, ah, good times. I'm so glad I saw this thing. So that's over at ID10T.com, the email list. But let's talk about you, the ID10T community, in the corkboard events at ID10T.com, like K.R. Renatus, who writes, I'm an actor and writer. I'm still in the beginning of my career, and I haven't gotten many opportunities yet, so I've been trying to make my own. I've created a web series called Video Diary of a Foster Kid. It's loosely based around my experience growing up in the foster system, and it has my whole heart. The first 5 episodes of Video Diary of a Foster Kid are available on my YouTube channel, K. Renatus. That's the letter K. Renatus, R-E-N-A-T-U-S. Thank you so much. No, thank you so much. What an incredible idea to create, especially for one of your first things, to create something so personal and then make a show about it. Just such an incredible idea. Congratulations. We will check it out. And I asked the ID10T community to also go check it out as well. And if you have stuff out there, the community that you would like to share at the Corkboard events at ID10T.com would be the way that you would do that. But let's talk about this episode. Billy Crystal, who's just the best. He's the best. I mean, just he's a legend, brilliant comedian. He is a comedian's comedian. He loves comedy, understands comedy, you know, the mechanics of it, loves to talk comedy. He's been on the podcast, I don't know how many times, but more than a few. I think going back to, 2012 or 13 maybe. Oh, that's right. I just remembered the first time he was on was to promote Monsters University. And I got to go up to the Pixar campus, which was one of the best things I've ever, it's really cool. But I got to go up there and talk to him. He was awesome then. He's been just fantastic every time he was on the podcast. I adore this man. And he has a gorgeous, beautiful movie that just came out. It's in theaters actually now, eventually to be on streaming, but it's actually in theaters called Here Today, which he stars in, co-wrote, and also directed. It's a dramedy, top to bottom. It's really funny in places and really heartfelt and sad in places. But Lydia and I watched it the other night and we loved it. The performances are great. And it's him and Tiffany Haddish, who's brilliant. And again, beautiful movie, highly recommended, out in theaters today and then streaming soon. And then also I found out in the podcast, Monsters at Work is a new Monsters thing that's coming to Disney Plus, I believe July 2nd, if the internet is to be believed. And so new Monsters, Billy Crystal's movie. And Billy, thank you so much for coming back on. I just think you're the best. And I greatly enjoyed this conversation on episode number 1119 of the ID10T podcast, which starts right now.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
Wow, I didn't know I could wear like a baseball hat. That would have been good. How are you, Chris?
It's good to see you.
You too. Who's your pal behind you?
Oh, those are from Disneyland. My wife and I. Actually, upstairs, we have a life-size Mike and Sully that she got from some entertainment auction.
Really?
Yeah.
So the big one, the plaster one or whatever it is?
The big furry, like Sully's big and furry, and Mike is like, you know, they're like full size.
Oh, like the standees from a theater lobby? You know, I had one for years, and, you know, we're doing this series, Monsters at Work for Pixar, which starts July 2nd.
That makes sense.
It's really good. And so I gave it to the people at Pixar. So it's now the little Mike Wazowski recording studio. So it's really cool.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I think these were in a toy store or something because they're like three-dimensional. Like they look like they were from the ride, maybe, possibly, California Adventure. Which we just went back to for a preview day of Disneyland, and we did the Monsters, Inc. ride, and it's a fantastic ride.
Oh, good.
Have you been on it?
Yes, several times.
I mean, you're in it, but I don't know if you've been
on it. Yeah, I know. Several times with my – it's a weird thing. It's my grandson, the little – when they were little, there's Grandpa, there's Grandpa. You know, but it's just a scary little green one-eyed guy.
I don't think I knew about the series. I didn't hear that they were making that. Are you doing like a full 20 episodes, 10, 20 episodes?
We did 10. John Goodman and I, great. Mindy Kaling, Henry Winkler, Bonnie Hunt, some other really wonderful people. It starts the day after the first movie ended.
Oh,
so we're now on the scare, the laugh floor. It's no longer the scare floor. It's the laugh floor. And Mike and Sully are in charge of harvesting laughs. And all new young characters and a couple of favorites. I'm watching you, Wazowski. She's there. And it's really – it's so well done. And we had a really good time doing it. So that starts July 2nd. So –
is that coming out? I imagine that's probably Disney Plus.
Disney Plus, yeah.
God, what an amazing, I feel like I keep having this conversation, but I guess just because it's such an unprecedented time in entertainment, just about how, just the way that we get things that are entertainment, it's just been completely leveled in terms of, you know, everything is everything now.
And how you can get things done. I mean, the fact that we're doing this now,
yeah,
I finished all of the posts after I had my cut of Here Today, right here at home with recording sessions with musicians in New York that I would be able to monitor with a camera and listen to with headsets and go through the score and rewrite music and so on. Color correction, looping, everything was done here because you couldn't go out. So it's pretty amazing.
Do you like having a place to go and having separation?
Absolutely. I love being in the room. I love being in the mixing board. I love being able to say, no birds there. No. Can I have more violin at bar 16? You like being surrounded by the people who do that.
Right.
You know, the great mixers, the great color correctors, you know, working with your DP on saturation. I love all of that stuff. But the fact we could get it done was a blessing.
I mean, it's like the pursuit of comedy, particularly comedians, is interesting because I feel like so much of what we do is very isolating. Like we're alone, we're writing, we're doing our set, we're on stage alone generally, but we love being around people, like that need to sort of like be isolated at times, but then be around everyone all the time is also true.
Yeah. You know, it's that word. You like to bounce. You want to bounce.
I see a Ben Schwartz in your background there on the
there he is. Yeah, there. Yeah, that's one of my favorite people and one of my favorite films.
Just
ending up falling down. Little beauty from last year.
My wife and I watched the movie last night, and I didn't really know much about it. So I did not have any preconceived. I had no idea what it was when I started watching it. And I started, I mean, it's gonna be I don't want to spoil too much talking about it, but I feel like we're going to have to spoil a little bit just to talk about it, because it really, it hit on so many amazing existential, not just sort of human things, but also just the comics journey too, which
it
hit me in a lot of places. I mean, the movie's fantastic. You're great in it. Tiffany's amazing in it. Like it's also, and it's funny, but utterly heart-shattering at this in places at the same time.
But in a yes, but because it's honest and it's real, and you know, when we started writing, when Zweibel and I started, Alan, one of my closest and dearest friends for 48 years now or something. He's an original SNL writer. I was involved with the show from the beginning, then hosting it a couple of times, and then coming as a cast member. We know that world, you know. So when I saw him on Letterman telling the story, which is the opening of the relationship between Tiffany's character and Charlie Burns, that happened to Alan. That was a true story. And he wrote it as a short story called The Prize, which I didn't know about at the time. But I saw him telling a story about this auction that this person bids on him. It's for a low number, like $22. He's now hating that he's at this lunch with somebody who lowballed him. And then she has a reaction to the seafood salad. He has to call an ambulance, get it to the hospital. She has no insurance. So this charity luncheon costs him $2,300. So I'm watching at home, watching him, and I started writing. I started going, Alan, this is the beginning of something. What a great way for them to meet. Who are they? Where do they go from there? Look, let's start. If you're interested, call me in the morning. This is a great jumping off point, !BC. And the next morning we called it and we started working and discussing who could they be and so on and so forth. And once we sort of got into that idea, all right, who are they? Alan and I both loved a senior writer at SNL named Herb Sargent. And Herb was in his 50s and nobody else was when the show started. And he was really kind of responsible for Weekend Update, I'm Chevy Chase, You're Not, General Franco Is Still Dead. Those are, you know, and he was a real socialite. He dated Gloria Steinem. He was a charming guy. And I thought, wow, it would be great if my character, taking Alan a step further, who actually had happened to, if he worked for a show like SNL. So we created this just in. So that was good. And then I was in Penn Station in New York, and I saw this charming young singer with like a gypsy jazz band in the waiting room at Penn Station with the train noises and interruptions. And I thought, she's great. Then I saw her again in Soho, on a corner of Spring Street, and the band was great. So I said, well, Alan, what if she was a street singer and had this band, and then, you know, and then so on and so forth. And then we started writing, and then I was dealing with a relative who had this problem that Charlie does in the movie, this onset of dementia. But she worked through it and worked with it. And I took care of her. And that we said, well, what if we do that? What's more, you know, it's so interesting and dramatic that a writer whose currency is his words is starting to go broke. And what would that be like? And could we treat it honestly, be funny, but be real at the same time? Then we might have something that would be more than funny, but heartfelt and it says something about empathy, friendship, devotion, and really what love is.
Right.
And so then it kept growing and growing. And then we finished, and then we went, all right, we like the script a lot. Who's this person? And I saw Tiffany on SNL, hosting SNL, because I had not seen Girls Trip at the time. And I went, bingo, who is that?
I was at that taping. I went to that, the taping, the live show. I was actually there watching it live. And it was incredible. She was incredible.
Yeah. And she's so vivacious and so funny and so electric. She has a little bit of the magic that Eddie Murphy had, at the same time, you know, that sort of thing, like you don't see it very often, and a great energy about her, and also she's so appealing. So we get her the script, and she arranges to meet with me, and she came in from Africa. She got off the plane and came from Africa, where she was actually spreading her late father's ashes in Africa per his wishes. And no makeup, no nothing, just exhausted. And we just hit it off. She was the talent for sure. You know that.
Yeah.
But what you have to find, Chris, you know, you have to find the heart of the person so then you can rewrite for her. And can she get to the places that the script demanded? Because she hadn't had a chance to do that yet. And that was why she loved the script and wanted to do it, because she wanted to stretch and grow, which she does. And then I found out she had just taken in her own grandmother, who was suffering from the beginnings of dementia, and was taking care of her. So it was like meant to be. It was meant to be, you know. So she was so willing to go where I needed her to go. And as her co-star and her director, that's the challenge of, well, I don't really want just Tiffany. I want Emma. I need Emma Page, but I need, at times, you'll be free enough to sprinkle, you know, and get that. And we have that in a couple of little places, but it's a beautiful performance. And I really loved working with her because she's, you know, she's like right there. She listens great. She's got great timing and she's fearless. And so was the character.
Yeah, she is. I used to do the show at Comedy Central called At Midnight. It was like a stand-up comedy game show, kind of a panel show. And I was performing at the Improv one night, and I walked, after my set, I walked over to the little annex room at the Improv. And that was the first time I saw her on stage, and she was performing for, you know, it was a small number of people, but she was murdering. I mean, like, murdering in a way that's really hard to do in a small room that's not necessarily full. And I texted our booker and I was like, do you know who Tiffany Haddish is? I'm watching her kill right now. And he booked her for the show. And what I didn't know is that her career was, our Girls Trip hadn't come out yet, but she was already on a show. She was starting to, she destroyed on our show, like right out of the gate, won the game. And I think I said to her that time or the next time she was on, I was like, I'm really appreciative that you're coming on the show now, because you're going to be too famous at some point. You're not going to be. So I'm glad that you're coming on now. And of course, Girls Trip came out and it was just like, boom. And then, you know, it much deserved, her career exploded. But it's so wonderful to watch talented people. It's one of my favorite things about comedy is watching funny people succeed, watching funny people show the world how fucking funny they are, and watching people get it. I mean, it delights me to no end.
Well, also, Chris, that in this performance, it's more than funny. It's more than just funny. And, you know, what was good about being opposite her, we could do a take, and while we're still rolling, I'd be able to say, just look her in the eyes and just say, a little less. Just don't bring anything else. And she'd go, got it. And then we would just keep going. It was that kind of relationship also, which was really fun, because, you know, every scene we have is together.
Do you think, I think a lot of comedy people make really amazing dramatic actors, just because I do think there's a self-awareness and a depth, and also comedy, you know, is a bit of a defense mechanism, you know, there's probably pain and suffering involved. And so I do believe that there's a lot of depth.
Yeah. The craft asks for you to use yourself and mine joy, pain, whatever the emotion is called for in the script, and to, you know, sometimes, you know, with stand-ups, you work in it's almost like a little glass booth that you walk around with when you're on stage, you know, and it's just, you're so confined and you get so used to what you do. It's when you free up and really trust yourself that you not only become a stand-up, but it becomes an art to it. And that's when it's creamy, you know, that's when it's really exciting. And it takes a while to get to that. It takes a while to develop the chops to trust that.
I think that's exactly the key is letting go, because I think stand-ups can be so used to just controlling the entire environment, you know, like controlling the room, everything, the jokes, all of it. And then coming into a situation to just let go and just trust that someone else is going to deal with all that.
Yeah. The best advice I ever got was when I first started out and it was from a genius manager who I was fortunate enough to be signed with. His name was Jack Rollins. Jack Rollins, Charlie Jaffe, Buddy Mora. Those were my first managers. And Jack was a genius and an eccentric guy who had Duke Ellington's eyes and fancied himself like an eccentric English professor at Brooklyn College or something, you know, mm-hmm. just always a little bit of a cigar, just a little bit, and tons of dandruff on his shoulders. I still don't understand. I just didn't go like this. Excuse me. And he was the first manager of Nichols and May. He got signed when Woody was just a joke writer, and then got him to perform on stage when he'd be throwing up backstage at the bitter end. And someday you're going to direct movies. And he was that guy. So I had like, when I first came out as a stand-up, it was like 74, 73 and a half. And I was with a comedy group that was signed to their office, right, for like the last 3-4 months of our tenure together. And we were three guys. It was a funny act called Three's Company, and they were my college friends. And we've been together a long time, like 4 years. And believe me, it's lonely at the middle. We just couldn't get there. But they came up to me, the managers, and said, listen, have you thought about being a stand-up, you know, working alone? Because we love the group, but it's not going anywhere. But if you wanted to work alone, we'll be there for you. We'd love to work with you. And it was like, of course, you know, yeah. And I felt like the last year in particular with them, I was sort of hiding. You know, I knew I needed to do this, but I was afraid. I was afraid. I already was married with a baby. So what was I going to do? I felt like my clock was ticking. I was 25, which was actually starting late in many ways, as far as I was concerned. And I left the group and I put together a really good 20 minutes. But it was, you know, there was impressions. It was Ali and Cosell. There were some other things. But Jack finally comes to see me after about 3-4 months. And I killed. I just killed. It was a great 20 minutes. And I was like so euphoric that Jack Rollins had seen me do this. So we're at this little restaurant after called the Green Kitchen. And Jack's across from me, and I'm thinking he's going to say, I'm not going to handle Woody anymore now that I've seen you. You know, that's what I'm thinking. Wow. And then he goes, how do you think you did tonight? And I said, all right, this is not going to go well. I said, well.
That's like a classic therapist question. How do you think you're doing? I don't know. Why don't you just?
Yeah, just tell me. So I said, well, the audience loved it. And he goes, I want to be honest. I didn't care for it. I went, oh, okay, as I'm gripping my butter knife, because I could, you know, just go Norman Bates on him right there. And he said, no, it's very effective. The audience laughed all the way through. But you know what? You didn't once say, I think. You never said, I feel. You know what bothers me? You never said that. You weren't in your own act. Because it's an act, very effective, but you know what? You didn't leave a tip.
Oh yeah.
And I went, what do you mean? He said, tip, you know, the little extra something you leave on the table, that they remember you by. You didn't leave a tip. And you're working too safe. You're a young husband. Yes. Yes. Okay. Right about that. You're a father, right? Young. No one else is a father here. Right. Right. Talk about that. That's what'll make you unique. Put yourself in your own act and be prepared to bomb. I would rather you be prepared to bomb than work safe. Wow. So tomorrow, come in again. Don't do any of this stuff. We know it works. Put together. I don't care if it's 5 minutes, 4 minutes, 3 minutes. Do something new, and then it'll grow. You'll see. It'll be like a dry sponge in water. It'll grow. Just talk about your life. Leave a tip. Leave a tip. And that's the greatest advice I've ever was given. And any young comic, whoever talks to me or wants any kind of in knowledge, I don't know, I tell them that story.
I've heard you mention leave the tip before, and probably like at least 10 years ago, and I've never forgotten it. And I still think about it. I still think about it when I'm writing, because it feels like that is kind of the, I think for a lot of comedians, the sort of journey is when you start off, you're half kind of mimicking your idols, you know, and you're half sort of saying, you know, what do people think is funny? And then I think there's this journey where you run out of stuff in the external world, but then you start going exactly what you said. Well, what do I think? What do I feel? And then it's just like takes a long time, 6 to 12 years usually, before you're just like, you are a fully formed identity of your own making on stage, and you're you, but a heightened version of you probably. And that took a long time to discover that, but I never forgot leave a tip. I always remember that.
Yeah, but that's when it gets creamy. That's when it gets really great, when you're not nervous before you go out there, because you know you just what you're going to talk about and how you're going to what you feel like talking about, and you don't give them what they're expecting. You give them something, surprise them. You're going to surprise yourself. You know, that's why I think I think for myself, you mentioned this the Standing Up, Falling Down movie, which I loved doing. I felt like it's some of my best work, personally, some of my best work, because the longer you live, the more you have to work with. there's more knowledge, there's more trust, there's more, it becomes effortless to get to those moments, even if they're difficult, because you can get to them. You've experienced them before. So, you know, I that's the exciting part about it. And for this movie too, which is a tough character to play, and do it the way, you know, it should be done, but you find the honesty in it and you go. For me, the prep was writing. We created this character. So I did a lot of my backstory because I, you know, wrote it. And so, but that's the thing, man. That's the thing is to find out, you know, what kind of instrument are you, and how do you keep yourself in tune, and what songs can you play on it?
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move, or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
When you sort of talk about, like, the longer you live, the more experience you have. I mean, I really see that in your performance in this movie, because I didn't see Charlie Burns as a as a character that Billy Crystal is playing, it's like, this is a guy. Like he, you, it didn't feel like, I mean, you know, your background, you do such amazing character work, but this, and he was a character in a movie, but he wasn't a character. He was a real.
No, thanks. Yeah.
Fully formed guy who had, and you really hit on so many, like, as I said before, like existential human things, but also particularly the life of the, you know, the overworked performer writer who's chasing and missing life in the interim.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe it's because of my age that I'm at now, but I really would love to explore this a little bit and just sort of get some advice on that. This idea of, you know, the balance of work, obviously work is fun, work is important. But it feels like as we get older, the lesson constantly seems to be work is important, but it's not everything.
Right.
Don't put it before the things that are important. And something that I don't want to spoil happens in this movie that is somewhat of the fallout of a work choice.
Right.
That he even kind of was like, and it wasn't even that, it didn't even, the thing I was doing didn't even really work. It was just, you know, and so what are your thoughts about the, you know, that kind of, if you pursue excellence, other things are going to suffer, but then you're not going to live a full life. I don't know. What do you
think? That's the burden of anyone who chooses an artistic life. There's a lot of sacrifice that has to be made, one, to make the work as good as you want to make it. And two, you know, what happens to the people around you and your life around you. When I really started to understand that, was around I'm gonna say around the 80s. You know, I have two daughters, and I was mostly on the road. This was before SNL and everything, so I was mostly a concert performer and starting to play bigger venues and that kind of stuff. And it was really, it was, you know, making money and it was nice, but I was on the road a lot until Janice, we're going to be married 51 years.
Oh, wow.
So we were kids. I was seven. She was six when we got married. It was a Hasidic.
Yeah. I mean, it goes back that far. Yeah.
We met in a room by the airport and they said, you're husband and wife. And went, oh, okay.
Okay. I guess that's how this works.
Yeah. And, she said, listen, the kids are missing you. I'm missing you. You don't want to be Uncle Daddy.
Right.
So, you know, maybe a little less. We, you know, say no. Money will be money. We're fine. And I got it. And then fortunately at the time, then SNL happened and we all went to New York together, which was great. And then when I came back, then movies started to happen and Running Scared happened. And so now my schedule was much more fitting for a home life, even though I'd go out of location, they were still young enough to come, but I wasn't gone, you know, 200 and something days a year. And that was the lesson. Don't be Uncle Daddy.
Yeah. But I also, you know, I look back at so many of the comedians that were so influential to me when I was growing up, and I see that there is a relative consistency to, and then at a certain point they stop doing stand-up.
Yeah.
You know, whether it, you know, it's you or Steve Martin, Steve, yeah, or Eddie Murphy or Robin, or it's just like there's a certain point where, and I feel like I'm starting to understand now, because at the time I was like, why would you stop doing? And now I'm starting to go, oh, because it is it's not the performing. It's just all the stuff around it. It's all of the travel and the five shows in a couple of days and doing the morning radio and, you know, hustling to sell tickets and, you know, like the up and down and the up and down.
It's the thinking. It's the thinking of, you wake up going, oh, at 8 o'clock, I got to be as funny as I've ever been. For an hour and a half or 2 hours. What city am I in? But it's also of looking, I need a new hunk. I need a new thing. And it's that bubble I talked about, that box you get in where you're just thinking about stuff.
Yeah.
What can I write about? What can I do? And it, it just crushes you sometimes. Unfortunately, you know, I had other things that I loved doing, like acting. I was getting and, you know, starting to become, you know, more, you know, getting more parts and so on. And then, but I'll tell you though, 3 years ago, I went out on a 35 city tour and I loved every second of it. And I couldn't wait to get out there. I did a show that was really stand up, but it was a talk show. Mm-hmm. A wonderful, wonderful, funny person and a great interviewer, Bonnie Hunt.
Oh yeah.
I asked Bonnie to go out with me, and it was basically a conversation for two and a half hours. And I showed clips and things but it was basically like doing a great Letterman for 2 hours.
Yeah.
You know, but it was stand up. And it led to me running back to the hotel to write down what I just said. You know, that was great too. It was like visiting an old friend, you know, so you never lose that. It's always there. It's a little dormant. You know, I'll always feel like I'm in one someplace. And there's very few places, honestly, in my life that I feel that comfortable.
Right.
You know, I feel comfortable still to this day fielding ground balls and taking batting practice somewhere with a machine or with somebody throwing. I still love to play one on nobody basketball by myself. And I love being on stage still. And so it's how I started out, you know, and you go back to it because it just led to everything. And when I had down periods, you could always go back to it.
Yeah.
And then it felt fresh and good again, instead of a burden, you know, and then it's great when you can go back to it. Yeah. I got something to say, I guess something, you know, the other day I started making notes about what, if I went out, what I would do. You know, and there's no place to do it, fortunately, but, you know, and then getting laughs on a talk show with no audience, you know, with any of the great talk show hosts is fun, but you miss the crowd, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Just that sort of voluminous, you know, the widening roar of the immediate response, which it's coming back now. I mean, I'm booking shows for the fall and a bunch of my friends are already like on the road. Like, you know, the second it seemed like things were lifted, they were just like, I'll be in Ohio. I'll be in Oregon. I'll be here. I'm like, holy shit. I mean, I'm excited to perform, but I'm still I still need a minute.
Yeah, no. Yeah. And I hope people aren't rushing, but you know, to get vaccinated and wear a mask and then it's, you know, more than likely you're in great shape.
Well, I feel like it definitely feels like we've turned a corner, and it definitely feels like, you know, by the fall, it seems that, it might be a new normal a bit, but it definitely feels like, okay, I think I'll feel okay going on the road, asking people to come show up together in a group. Was there, when you were starting out, was there like a particular comedy snobbery in terms of like, well, stand up is this or this, but it's not this? I mean, I feel like a lot after the 80s comedy boom, because I started in the 90s, there was a little, well, comedy is, it's just a person telling jokes, but it's not this, that's too hacky or thirsty or whatever. And now I sort of feel like it's anything that really kind of works for the audience. I mean, is that just sort of a young comedian's snobbery about like trying to dictate like it's this or that?
Who's to say what's the way?
Right.
You know, there is none. That's why, you know, a few years ago, you know, so long ago, if you said, oh, he's going to wear a white suit, play banjo and have an arrow through his head, you'd go, that's what, but it was, you know, it was, he turned comedy into arenas, you know, and that was, you know, and what Andy would do, you know, to dare to lip sync, you know, Mighty Mouse and do all the other, and to wrestle and do all the other crazy things that Andy did. So there's, you know, everyone's got their own genius to them. It's just, it's a fascinating art since the beginning of time. And, you know, there's probably cave paintings that have a sense of humor about them, I bet, you know? There's probably some caveman throwing a woman to a T-Rex, and that's, you know, take my wife, please. Probably
take my buffalo. You know, like there's something, somebody.
So I'm trying to make fire, and you know, it's probably.
Well, you know, if you look up, this is a real thing. But if you look up Pompeii graffiti, they uncover all this graffiti from Pompeii that is like it. I mean, it's translated obviously from Latin, but it's just like, fuck, that's graffiti. That's the same. Those are the same kind of things people write on bathroom walls now, you know, it's just the same.
That's hilarious. That's hilarious. Well, and Harry and Sally, I had lived a line. They're looking at the Sphinx. It's, I guess Hieroglyphics is a comic strip about a character named Sphinxy. And, you know, it might be something like that.
I mean, it's, you know, this, what you talk about, like going back on stage and sort of feeling it again and then sort of being drawn back to it, and that never goes away. It makes me think of Joan Rivers, who I was really lucky to get to know in the few years before she passed away. I absolutely adored her. And Joan was someone who would still be performing today, you know, if she were here. And I always admired that about her and Mel Brooks too, because it seems like what kept them going was a hunger and a curiosity, and they always wanted to learn, and they wanted to understand, and they wanted to consistently create. But I hope they found peace too, you know, because I wonder for myself if what comes with that drive is just not ever being able to sit still. I mean, does creating art nonstop, do you think creating art nonstop means that you're never able to really just slow down and feel satisfied? I mean, will I be able to be hungry and achieve, but simultaneously be peaceful? Is that even possible?
This has worked for me. You know, I found a great balance in my life because I found a great balancer. You know, Janice and I, again, 51 years, 2 kids, 4 grandchildren. That's, you know, I have other stand-up friends who come over and go, how did you do this? How did you do this? And I go, meet my wife. Yeah. You know, meet me. So, you know, we fell in love at 18. I was 18, she was 17. And that's been, and the basis of it is we laugh a lot. She is really funny. And because I'm one of those guys, I'm one of those guys. I'm a generous laugher, but I'll also study it at sometimes at the same time. I go, funny. Right? But, you know, but that's been a thing that that is most important, is that I've been able to balance this and find joy in all of my work and all of my life.
Yeah. And do you have
to live? They gotta be separate though. You can't blur the lines. And I have at times, you know, cause it's so elusive, Chris, it's so elusive, you know, success for that satisfying.
Right.
You know, that means something to you. I mean, look at this. I'm 73 and I co-wrote, I acted and I directed in this movie, and I'm nervous like crazy because it's opening Friday. And I always feel, and I always did, no matter what success or failure, that I always had to prove myself again, either to public or to myself, that I could still do it, you know? And do it better than I ever have. And that's what's such a thrill about having this movie open, is that people are really, you know, liking the movie and they're moved by it. And I laugh at it. You know, I was the oldest guy in the set, but I was the youngest one at the same time. I had more energy than anybody because I had to.
Yeah.
But you know, but that's the thrill of it still after all these years, that nothing... I don't know how to put it, about not feeling totally, I think there's a danger about feeling totally safe. That, there's something about it that you have to always kind of figure a way out of something that gets exciting. So it's either writing something else, directing the scene differently. How do I tell Tiffany what I need here? Am I saying it right? There's always a challenge. And I think that's pretty cool. You know, I'm already writing something else and looking forward to getting that done, you know?
I mean, but also to direct yourself in scenes that are really, I mean, is there a separate person that you're able to sort of bounce off of when you're giving a performance, or are you able to have the separation to see yourself? I'm the director and now, but I'm watching myself as the actor and I think I need to do this or a little bit, or is someone going, oh, you know, tweak this, or is it all just you like watching back?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. Fortunately, I had Alan was there. So his wife Belle was there. And I would, sometimes I just look off and go, I knew what I needed and I knew what I felt was right. And I knew that Charlie was raw and I had to go to a place that was, for me, raw. And when he gets, you know, kind of news that he doesn't want in a scene with her and he explodes at her, that was one of those days. And I had to really explain this to Tiffany when she had a very emotional moment in the movie later. You have to stay in the pain. You have to stay in the moment. You just can't turn it on and off. So if you do a really good take, don't run to your phone. Stay in the thought. Stay in. It's uncomfortable, but you'll feel it'll be true, because the frustrating thing about movies and the exhilarating thing about movies is they're forever. Mm-hmm. Whatever moment, movies are a collection of moments. So if you make the right moment, it's there forever. And I surprise her, you know, when he just blurts, he's terrified and he's emotional. And as part of the illness that he has, he strikes out at people on occasion. But that's just part of it. So I had to really trust myself. And then there were many times that when I finished a scene or a take, I didn't look at the playback. Mm-hmm. Because it felt good.
Right.
And then I would look at the DP, you know, do we get it? We're good. Cause I'd set up all the shots with him and his name is Vanya. And I said, Vanya, good. And he'd just go like this. So I knew that I had it. So yeah, it's a complicated job to do everything. But for this one, I sort of had to. I didn't want anyone else to do it.
I think probably the most challenging thing to get around directing yourself would be like which part of your ego to put to sleep.
Yeah.
You know, like if you're watching yourself as an actor watching your acting, you're like, oh my, I look weird. That's a strange angle. You know, it's like, no. You gotta put that part to bed so you can then see yourself. You know, it's like which part of your ego are you servicing?
Yeah, no, because, you know, there were times on the set also, whatever the scene was, and it was on me, and I go, cut, well, that stunk. And they would laugh, and, you know, and it would relax people. It would relax me sometimes. And then I'd step back and go, what's missing? I'd talk to Alan, I'd talk to Tiffany, and then I'd figure out what was right to do and what was wrong to do. I sort of, you know, felt like I was a cast member in a movie that I was directing.
Oh, that's an interesting way to think about it. But also, you know, you talking before about, I'm still thinking about like the $22 of it all.
Yeah.
I think that's so representative of how difficult it is to know. I mean, everyone at the core of it just wants to know, am I doing a good job? And that question can be dangerous because your brain can start feeding you bad answers. Oh, well, your $22 means you're not doing a good job. You know, it's like you can't control that. Or, you know, the idea that Well, you know, again, you have to sort of release whatever you can release. You can't control if something's going to do well. You can't control if you're going to work. You can't control any of that thing. But again, as comedians, our job is to that we depend on the reaction from the audience. So it's difficult to go, oh, yeah, I just won't worry about the outcome because there are outcomes that are vital to what we do. And so in the amazing career that you've done, literally the biggest things a person can do, is just sorting through that. Is Janice really the sort of key anchor that has kept you tethered to not spin off in weird directions or place value in weird places or feel bad about yourself when you don't need to, when you're trying to find like, what does success actually mean?
Oh yeah. Yeah. And my kids. And a lot of soul searching over the years and working on myself also to grow muscle.
Yeah.
And it's not a kind life sometimes. And it's definitely not a kind business sometimes. Because you know, like right now, you know, I put my heart and soul into this. It's based on so many truths, and somebody with a keyboard may write, "I hate this thing." You know, it's so. But so that you get, you know, I'm in a precarious for me now point, and the fact that we wake up together and that's really the important thing, and so that's the balance for me always. Yeah, that's the anchor. And also knowing that I'm strong enough to take that, if there is that, and it probably will be some element of that, and move forward and keep the perspective, you know. You got to be a horse in front of the plaza, I used to call it. Because the Plaza Hotel, there were all of the Central Park horses would line up and they'd all have the blinders on.
Yeah.
And they couldn't see the traffic. They couldn't see anything else except where they had to go. So that's what I'm going to be. I decided years ago, I'm going to be a horse in front of the plaza, which is a good book title.
That's a good book title. It's a good special. You know, you could easily do another special if you felt like it, you know, like
that's what I started like writing about, you know, when I finished with my tour with Bonnie, we did again, 35 cities, some one nighters and then jumping, you know, in a car or a plane to get to the next date. It was so great. And then I had so much stuff that we had mined together that I could now, you know, do alone. And then formed an act, you know, new thing that way. So I look forward to, I would like to do something like that and feel free, you know, you know, the thing about the $22, and this is part of the same thought, I'm not wandering, folks,
no,
is the 22 bucks. And he says, that's so sad. Charlie, well, that's so sad. Is that what I'm worth now? Mm-hmm. Is that all it is? Is that all anybody wants to, you know, $22? That's what Charlie's going through in that point of his career. And that's what, you know, when it really happened to Alan, that's what it broke his heart, you know. And then she orders a salad that costs more than what she paid for the auction.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
But it's such a great lesson in like how dangerous it is to place your own value into things that you can't control, you know, or into metrics that wouldn't have meant anything to you before. Like this character wouldn't have thought, I wonder how much I would be worth in an auction. But then all of a sudden it's a defining moment for him, you know? And so it's not being, and not just those moments where you have the opportunity to feel bad about yourself, but I think on the other side too, you know, like when you have the big wins, how do you process it and appreciate it, but not have it mean everything? You know what I mean? Like, how do you not get swept up in it?
Yeah, I mean, you have to, that comes with knowing who you are as a person. That's with working on yourself as a person, not just as a performer.
Yeah.
And feeling confident in that. The last time I was in front of people, it was interesting. I keep in really good shape, and I don't really, do anything to excess. And I remember I was, I did a Colbert, and I loved that theater. The Sullivan Theater was where I made my network television debut.
Wow.
For the Howard Cosell variety show. The Beatles were there. Every stand-up I ever saw on a Sunday night on Ed Sullivan was there. And there's something about the setup of it that's an amazing place to perform in. And we did three segments, and then we talked through the commercial breaks, and I just started performing for the audience, telling jokes and things and stories and so on and so forth. So when I came off, I felt like I had just done 45 minutes of a really good show. And then Janice and I went out, and I ate a 4-pound lobster and had a drink and then a dessert. And then that was to me was like, oh, all right. Yeah, good. There's room now. I can, I did my job, and it was very satisfying. Now I can reward myself. That's the other thing, you know, you leave a tip with the audience, but you leave one for yourself too.
Right.
And give yourself room to feel good about yourself. That's within limits where you don't blow it up, you know? There's a great story to joke about two actors. It's an actor, and I want to get it right. It's an actor in Summer Stock, and he goes to do the play, and there's 12 people in the audience, so they cancel the show. They can't do the show. 12 people. So he goes to the bar afterwards, and the bartender says, no show. He said, nah, only 25 people showed. And you know, it's just that
just to feel a little bit, but those metrics really are difficult to not define when they really do depend on the success of what you do to do more of it. And you know, I heard you tell the story about the first Tonight Show you were on. And I tried to find it because you were on and Orson Welles was on, and I think it was 75.
Yeah.
And I couldn't find it online. I'm always disappointed by the internet. I'm like, internet, come on, you got everything. But this is the one thing I can't find. But the story you told about when the stage manager would say, like, stay where you are or go to the couch, meaning, and every comedian knows that means, oh, if you go to the couch, you're anointed by Carson. And if you don't get that, how can you not be how can you? And it could be for a variety of reasons. Maybe they didn't have time, or maybe he, or whatever. But that defining moment, and you got called over to the couch.
Yeah.
And that was life-changing, I would imagine, for a lot of reasons.
For a lot of reasons, yeah. I remember it vividly, and sitting next to Johnny, he said some really lovely things when I finished my stand-up spot, and I saw the guy do that and shook his hand, shook Wells's hand, sit down, and he said something very nice leading to commercial about always great to see a young comic come out here and do something a little different, and it worked for you, and we'll be right back. And And Craig Tennis was the talent coordinator for that my stand-up spot. And he had told me, don't look at Johnny. Don't look at him in the commercial break.
Like a gorilla. Don't look him in the eye. Don't look him
in the
eye.
Yeah. Don't in the commercial break. He won't like it. Don't do it. And I got Wells on my right and Johnny's drumming with his pencils and the band is fantastic. And I'm, you know, here I am. I've been looking at this set for years and now I'm looking at him and he was like such a superstar to me. Yeah. He was such a fucking god. Yeah. I mean, and he had these chiseled features and he's drumming away and he looks over just for a second and he knows that I'm staring at him. And I just went, how's it going?
Yeah.
And he laughed and he went, it's going pretty good. It's going pretty good. How's it going?
Do you like food? What do you like? I don't know. What do you fucking say? What are you supposed to say to Johnny? What do you say?
I'm trying to get your sign. What are you?
There's just like a fire sign. I don't know. Well, okay, you gotta go back to work. Okay, sorry. Yeah, I was.
Oh God,
myself, everyone.
It was too crazy. It was too crazy.
Did you ever feel comfortable going back, or did that imprint in you in a weird way? Did you ever kind of?
Oh no, I then got very comfortable over time, and then the coolest thing happened. I got a call from him the morning after the Oscars. I guess it was 1998. To this day, it's the highest rated Oscar show of all time. It's a Titanic show, and
right.
It was a particularly good show. I have to say, I had a strong show, and 9 o'clock in the morning. I had gotten in around 4 and couldn't sleep because it was so fucking exciting.
Of course. Yes, it doesn't matter. Right.
It was so fucking exciting. And that was when I let myself feel really good. And the phone rings and it's my assistant Carol saying, Johnny Carson is on the phone.
Jesus Christ.
So I went, what? No, no. I'm thinking it's Chris Guest. You know, or Marty Short, who could, you know, do him. Are you sure it's him? She said, yes, it's him. And he wants to talk to you. What do I say? I said, tell him the fuck off.
Yeah.
And she goes, boss, why? No, I'm kidding. And now I'm sweating like Albert Brooks in Broadcast News. I mean, I was just, and I took a deep breath and went, hello. And he goes, you know, and he went on and on in the best way. Couldn't have been more just gracious and thrilling to hear him praise what I had done the night before. And he said, you know, I'm just sitting there going, look at this guy. He just went on and on. And I said it to my wife, isn't he something? And she goes, why don't you call him and tell him yourself? So his wife, Alex, had told him to call. And he called at 9 o'clock in the morning. And we talked for about a half hour. And it was really like I was exhausted from the phone call, but I still live off it. I still feel it. You know,
that would have been funny if you were like, "So how's it going?" I mean, in that moment, probably
a call back. And then 61 debuts on HBO, which just had its 20th anniversary movie I directed about Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle, and it was shown the other night. And I sat and I watched it. And I hadn't seen it in years and was thrilled that they wanted to honor it again. And the morning after that debuted, Johnny calls and I picked up and it was him. And he goes, I'm sending you something that I think you're going to like and it's going to come today. And when you get it, give me a call and here's my number and so on and so forth. And he hung up. So a delivery guy brings a DVD from 1962, Johnny in full Yankee uniform in Yankee Stadium pitching to Mickey Mantle for a segment for The Tonight Show. And he's hilarious. And the way they set up the shots, and it was on film, right? So you see great Yankees, Roger Maris, Mickey Mantle, Elston Howard, other Yankees walk out of the dugout, and then Johnny, like, in a uniform that was didn't fit, and he was and he played it so well, like little Jack Benny, sad sack, and he goes out and he walks the wrong way to the mound, and Mantle says, "Hey, Johnny, it's there." "Oh, right." And he walks out to the mound, and he's pitching to Mantle, and it was a segment on the show, and he wanted me to have it, and it was like, and it's an astounding piece of video. I mean, it's wild that you end up connecting with these guys who make you want to do what you end up doing, you know?
This may be a weird question and a weird piece of advice to ask for, but just in general, but when Johnny Carson calls you, when Johnny says, "Hey, okay, you've just hosted the biggest Oscars ever. You kill. It's just this pinnacle, like beyond your wildest imaginations. When you're a young performer, you're probably doing way beyond what you thought you could have wanted to do to be happy. And all of a sudden and then Carson calls you the next day. I mean, how are you supposed to feel? Like, how do you process that in a healthy way? You know what I mean? Like, how do you even begin to break that down? Is a lot of it done retrospectively where you look back and go, "Holy shit, did that happen?"
Well, yes, because I just told you and I still feel that way. But at the time, I didn't tell a lot of people that this had happened because it was mine.
Yeah.
And I didn't want anyone to feel like I was bragging in any way. It was such a personal gift that you know, on occasions like this, that I bring it out and look at it again, like, wow, that was something. And it was a pretty, I was overwhelmed. I was overwhelmed, I have to say. And, you know, I the fact that it felt so good doing that Oscar night, that was a really good one of the nine. I like some better than others, you know, because they were better than some were better than others. But that one was a particularly good one. The fact that he had done it five times and sought me out as with appreciation, and there was nothing else to it, you know, was it's kind of. I still just shake my head sometimes. Like that was a great one. That was a great moment.
But I see that in the, and I think, I assume that also probably because you recognize the humanity of that moment, it creates a level of empathy where you are also generous to younger performers, because that is also like a sub story in the movie.
Yeah.
A young writer who's having a hard time. And it turns out he just fucking idolizes you. He knows every inch of your career. And your character just kind of taking the time to help him sort some sketches out and just talk to him and listen to him. It's like you, it's just like the passing of the torch. Like you see that and you know that because you have given him this moment, he is probably someday when he is an incredibly successful performer writer, going to give that moment to someone else too. It's just this constant, like
the relay race. It's the relay race.
Yeah. The relay race.
And in here today, you know, the Daryl character, ends up helping me finish my life's work. And, you know, in a beautiful moment towards the end of the movie, and he's there. And, you know, that's the continuity that is, I think, you know, it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. And I think also it feels like, especially at this point, the more stand-up you do, the probably the main difference as we get a bit older is doing stand-up because we love it and we enjoy it, not because we need it for some type of weird validation to exist.
Right. You know,
that it's enjoyable. Because when you go on back on the road, I'm sure some of it's going to feel the same, but also, I mean, you're going to do well. Like, you know, people are, you know, it's like, as opposed to the early days where it's like, oh man, I got a minute. I got to win the crowd over. I'm not that you know, like the crowd still expects you to do well, but I mean, it probably just feels a lot nicer now.
Oh yeah. I mean, listen, you don't have to fight. that, you know, that kind of that first couple of minutes. And then, you know, when I walk the stage in the beginning and look at people and try to be as informal as I can, and you look at the audience and they're older than you, then that's they've been there a long time, you know, so it's a fascinating time now with what people need and how can we get it to them, which is entertainment.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. And just like the sort of the need for silliness and the need for fun and the need for comedy and the, you know, like it, but I am stuck on this idea of leave a tip. And I would love to, if you, in the process of leaving a tip. And again, I don't want to overshadow the fact that this manager is amazing that he took the time to have the insight to tell you that, because you're very lucky, because a lot of managers might've just gone, great. You know, like, they just see dollar signs. This kid's killing. That's all that matters, is killing. And right. He had the soul and the humanity to say, like, yes, you can do that, but there's so much more for you that's of so much more depth, and you should explore that. The very artistic, to choose art over commerce is incredibly insightful.
Well, that's why Jack and Charlie and Buddy Mora, who became my day-to-day guy for 40 years, were to me the best, because they were really smart and insightful in their appreciation and understanding of the art of stand-up and comedy or writing. You know, the last time I saw Jack, he was 100 years old.
Oh, my God.
And, yeah, and he passed away right when The Comedians came on. I saw him the night before it debuted. And he was still with a little bit of cigar, still with a dandruff on his shoulders, still talking about what was funny and how much I sent him the shows in advance. And he really liked him. And he had managed Letterman and was the executive producer on Letterman as he sort of headed into retirement. And I carry him around with me, because he was such an important part of my understanding me and understanding the art of performing and writing and your responsibility not only to yourself but to the audience, that relationship, you know. He's an extraordinary guy.
Last question. When you're forming something and you go, there's something here, I don't know what it is yet, but I just feel like you just get that spider sense, like there's just something here.
Yeah.
And you think about, you know, how do I make this me? How do I leave the tip? What are a couple of questions that you ask yourself to sort of get through some of the barriers as you're developing bits, if you're stuck or you're trying to figure out like how to leave a tip, if you feel like I left my wallet at home. Like what are the couple of questions that you ask yourself?
Is this worth it? Is it worth it?
That's a good question.
Is this worth anything? And you know, I got to know Stephen King for a little bit at Castle Rock when they would Rob was doing Misery, and we talked about doing a funny approach to a horror film. Did he think there was something that we could do to get something like that? And he said, "Let me think about it." And then we were talking about writing, and I was sort of new in my writing career. And he talked about what he loved the most. And I think some of it might be in Misery, in the book. He talked about the howabouts, that a writer loves howabouts. And the howabout, you know, for me now is like, if that happens, if there's a howabout, you go after it. You dive right through the computer screen and you swim in it. And if there's something great, and it keeps you going to the next thing, great. If not, you just press delete or copy and save it at the, you know, for maybe it's something else. But you just keep experimenting, and some days you find your way. Because there's no Waze app for writing. it'll take you where it'll take you, you know, and you just trust it. I finished writing something that I had no idea where I was going to go. I just had an idea for a beginning, and it led me into a whole world I had no idea that I was going to end up in. And it was exhilarating. I don't know what'll ever happen with it, but it's there. It's a screenplay, and I did it during the pandemic, and I just kept going. And I, you know, in those horrible days where we felt like, you know, can't go out. It's out there. It's in the air. We you know, but where is this virus? Well, if you touch this, if you touch that, you got to wash the avocados when you get them. You got to, you know, you get all of that fear locked in basically this room where I'm talking to you now for, you know, 14 months. The godsend was coming in and writing. That was the, to me, that was, for myself, was the ability to just sit and explore and play around for an hour or two before I had a vacuum and do my ironing, which I'm very good at, by the way. I've gotten very good.
Listen, it's good to develop skills in a pandemic. You know what I mean?
You never know.
Especially now we've had to become our own production crews, our own lighting crew. Like, we have to do our own makeup. It was fine. You know, it's fine. It's
good. Hey, man, I spent last night ironing flat sheets. So
someone has to.
Yeah, one of those machines that you see in dry cleaners, that thing.
And they're not called wrinkle sheets. They're called, you got to flatten them.
Flatten them. Yeah.
I do have to tell you, as we're leaving, these moments that were so impactful to you, you gave me one of those moments. And I think I told this to you the first time you were on the podcast, but it was probably almost 10 years ago. So I'll just tell it again. But in 1998 or 98, maybe, you were doing a tour for Analyze This. And I was asked to moderate a live panel at UCLA, which they beamed to a bunch of colleges, where they would screen the movie and then I would come out and moderate. And it was you and De Niro and Harold Ramis. And I was supposed to moderate the, you know, like interview you and moderate the Q&A. And it was the first thing like that I had ever done. And of course I was terrified. It's you and it's Harold Ramis. It's, you know, the Egon and the guy who directed Groundhog Day and SCTV. Backstage, they had to pull me back. I didn't see the second half of the movie because we had to get ready for the panel. And I met Harold Ramis and he was like, "Oh, what'd you think of the movie?" And I go, "Oh, I didn't get to see the second half of it." And he goes, "Oh," he fucking explains, like acts out the second half of the movie to me like a kid. It was one of the most, like, I couldn't contain what was happening. Probably like your call with Carson, like, how is this happening? So we go, you were very nice. I don't think I met De Niro. We all get out on stage. I'm talking to you, good rapport, talking to Ramis, he's great. I get to De Niro and he's just, you know, sort of that classic, like, he's just shut down. He just doesn't like to do that stuff. That's fine. I did not have the experience. I did not have the tool bag to navigate that situation. And for some reason, I guess to try to be funny, because he wouldn't answer questions, I just go, "What's your favorite cereal?" Like, I don't know what the fuck I was thinking. I just kind of, it was kind of that, "How are you doing? You know, how's it going?" And his reaction was just sort of like, he wasn't interested in playing the yes and game. And was just like, I don't. And thank everything, you go, "Lucky Charms." Like, you kind of jumped in front of the frame. And
took the bullet for him. I took the bullet. Yeah.
And you took the bullet and everyone laughed. And that was the end of that was pretty much the end of the panel. And you gave us our like blackout curtain and you were so nice to me afterwards, after what was such a devastating, like, I was so devastated by how I fucked that up. And it really taught me a lesson of like empathy and listening and helping out when you can help out. And it was, I just need you to know that that was so impactful to me. And I really have appreciated it my entire career. Oh, cool.
I remember it. I do. Oh man. Yeah. A junket with Bob is an experience.
Listen, not everyone likes to do those things. There's nothing wrong with that.
No, I know. He's a genius actor and one of my closest friends and the sweetest guy, smart guy. But, you know, we would do these junkets. It'd be the two. He always insisted that we do them together.
Of course.
Because I do the lifting.
Yeah.
And, you know, And it was basically like Burns and Allen. I remember George Burns saying, all I did was say, Gracie, how's your brother? And she would talk for 20 minutes and I would point to her. Because I got to a point where I could point with either hand. And that's what it was like with us.
I just wanted to say thanks.
I appreciate that.
You were very much like, hey, you'll be okay. You know, you did a great job. Like it could have been one of those moments where I was like, well, I'm not ever doing this again, you know, like, so, well, that was that. But anyway, I just wanted to say thanks. And you've always been so nice and generous. And I just can't tell you how much I appreciate it. And the movie is just a beautiful, gorgeous movie.
Thank you.
And I know it comes out May 7th, which I believe is the same day the podcast is posting. Is it theatrical?
Only theaters. It's only 1,200 theaters across the country.
Right.
We had opportunities to stream it. But you know, my producing partner, Fred Bernstein, said, no, I want this. People loved it. We had two test screenings that went great and people did what you want them to do in a theater. And he says, I want that for this movie. I want that experience. And then Sony swept in and said, we want this in theaters. And here we go Friday, May 7th. So folks, if you feel healthy and safe to go and go check it out, it's a full movie experience, I think, for an audience. That's what you want in a film.
It absolutely is. It has a great emotional core and it's funny and the performances are great and it's heartfelt and it's just a nice journey. It's just beautifully directed and acted. And I really I'm so happy for you and for Tiffany so congratulations. And
thanks, Chris. And by the way, Vanilla Kashi.
Oh, that's a new favorite cereal.
That's my, yeah. I don't know what Bob's is. Call him if you want to hold on.
It's a frosting. You know, it's actually Lucky Charms.
Right? I still love Lucky Charms. Still
it'd
like
it. It'd be really funny if he left that, you know, if he kind of grumbly like got in his car and went home and just opened a cabinet of like all these cartoon cereals. or he in the car, he's like, I can't believe that guy asked me the question. And then the Trix Rabbit's like, who knew? You know, like, I feel like there's something.
We'll work on that. We'll work on that for the sequel to this.
Thanks again, and congratulations on the movie. And
thanks, appreciate it. Always good to talk to you, man.
You too, man. Take care.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.
Hey, listeners, it's Will Arnett. Our podcast, Smartless, has crossed a milestone that seemed unfathomable when we started nearly 4 years ago, as we've just released our 200th episode. Join us as we welcome that dynamic duo of hilarity, Steve Martin and Martin Short. You've seen them on screen together in The Three Amigos, Father of the Bride 1 and 2, and most recently, and only Murders in the Building. Both are comedic geniuses in their own right, but together they are always electric. And this episode of Smartless is no exception. I don't know if I've laughed more in a single episode than this one. We discuss their career arcs both separately and as a comedy team, how they met, who is more difficult to work with, and what motivates them today. Is Steve a better banjo player than Marty as a singer? Find out on this bicentennial episode of Smartless. Follow Smartless in the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Smartless ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Plus, you get to hear Sean cry. What a loser!